Group meeting, Sunday, 23rd June, 1985. I think a word or two is necessary in connection with this phrase, the realization of the transcendent. It is not the individual who realizes the transcendent. It is transcendence which realizes itself as the perfect human through that person. That's a rather hard pill to swallow. There is absolutely nothing for me, the individual. When I die completely as the individual. But transcendence has realized itself through me if I have done the needful. Just as transcendence realizes its own transcendence in the perfect flower or the perfect gem or whatever, or the perfect animal or bird or whatever it is. This is something which I don't think one finds in the religious texts of the world. We all talk in terms of attaining this, achieving that, establishing the kingdom of God on earth, or entering nirvana, or the kingdom of heaven, or whatever it is. Some goal for me, the separate individual, the permanently identifiable entity. And that is a tremendous illusion. It's the carrot held out to the human donkey throughout the ages. I dare say this is a terribly austere outlook, but to me it is the truth. Because when we think of ourselves and say I or you when we talk to another person and so forth, what exactly are we referring to with that word I? Our self-concept is associated exclusively with some aspect or other which composes the individual being, the individual living person, who goes by the name of John Smith or Mary Brown or whatever it is. Now, all that composes the manifested individual does not survive its ending. Whatsoever has a beginning, by nature, has an ending, as the Buddha taught. But I doubt if even the Buddhist world appreciates and understands the significance of that fully. The manifestation completely disappears. Transcendence, the totality, the absolute, whatever is the reality, that remains the reality. That reality, transcendence itself, is embodied completely in us. This embodied transcendence is but the manifestation. The manifestation which comes into being, there's a starting point, there is a proceeding process, and then there is the ending. So I, the self-conscious individual, completely go out of existence. It is transcendence which remains. Now you see, when one really sees that, it is an extraordinary help in becoming free of all selfness. By selfness, I particularly mean the isolative, separative self-consciousness and the belief that one is permanent. You say, my spirit is eternal and immortal. There is no such thing as my spirit or my soul, or my mind, using mind in the supreme sense. Consider for a moment. Here is, we said there is so much space in this room, and we say that in space the whole world and the whole cosmos exists and so forth. Now, here is space, there is space, there is space. Now, which space is my space? Space contains me. I have no space at all. And you see, that which is the transcendent, that which belongs to the context of the infinite and the eternal, cannot be split up into little bits, each of which is immortal and remains an identifiable entity. Now, in the Buddha taught that the manifested being completely disappears, and in the Upanishads too, although it is not stated as openly as I have stated it just now, there is the indication that what is the ultimate reality only, and there is nothing else. So when I strive for nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or perfection or whatever it is, I am just being selfish and foolish, following a mistaken idea, a chimera, non-existent. So then we ask, in that case, why should we strive to live the good life and all the rest of it if there is absolutely nothing for ourselves? Well, I'll ask a question in reply to start with. What is the option for me? Have I any option? Oh yes, says the believer in a permanent heaven for him and so forth. Your soul will go into heaven. You see, if you are good, otherwise you will go to the other place. Now, can he produce his own soul and say, this is my soul? Can he lay his finger upon anything in me and say, this is your soul? When the great teachers gave the teaching that the soul is immortal, if they meant by that, if by the word soul, the reality, the absolute all, the indescribable, the unseizable. You see, this is where in the Upanishads, Yajnavalkya really gives the hint that the Atma is unseizable. You cannot get hold of it. Now, what is the significance? There is no such thing as a separate personal Atma. The later philosophies developed the idea of Jivatma as a spark of the divine which is eternal in you. Supposing you have a fire which lasts continuously, somehow or other, like Moses' burning bush, which was never consumed, you see. Supposing you have a fire like that. Now, if there is any spark which comes out of it, it's turned to cinder in double quick time. So there's no such thing as an eternal spark of an eternal fire. It's a whole, the totality, the unitary whole. It is this consciousness, this real consciousness of the unitary wholeness of everything that we have to wake up to. Then you'll say, well, what is fulfilled by the individual striving? by the individual striving, the totality is fulfilled. Look, even materially speaking, if you invent a gadget which is really useful, are you the only person who benefits by that gadget? The whole country benefits by that gadget, doesn't it? It is like that. Whatsoever good I do benefits the totality, of which I am a part. And therefore, I too receive some sort of benefit, which I rarely see for myself where the spiritual life is concerned. If one can understand this, really understand it, so that one becomes totally conscious of it, one ceases to live the self-centered, selfish life, which is always at the expense of other people and so forth. So, it is not I who realize the transcendent, but the transcendent realizes itself through me, through you, as the perfect human. It is not the rose bud which attains perfect beauty. It is transcendence which realizes its perfect roseness and its perfect beauty through the rose. Fortunately, the rose has no separative self-consciousness. See how it blooms, how wonderful it is. Any flower. Why can't we be like that flower? However, we have to go through all these stages of selfness in order to realize that state of humanness which is the perfect human. Now, to get to chapter 2. Immediately the question arises, can the heart of religion be communicated through the medium of thought or speech? As long as we are self-conscious, we are as opaque matter obstructing the light. When we are reduced to our nothingness, the transcendent is here. In this experiencing of the infinite, we are unself-conscious. We do not know God, but God knows us. We cannot know God, for our kind of knowing is incapable of grasping the infinite. The knowing by the infinite of us is other than what we can mentally perceive. Now, to take this point, as long as we are self-conscious, we are as opaque matter obstructing the light. Self-consciousness has to be with us and used in our life. If we are not self-conscious, we cannot possibly move about in the world in the right way without barging into something or somebody. The trouble with self-consciousness is not the self-consciousness. The trouble is that our self-consciousness is isolative and separative. I am I and not somebody else. And you are you and not me. Now, this is the root consciousness which brings into being the fundamental duality and all its unfortunate consequences into our lives. The self and the not-self. I am vividly conscious of myself. Oh yes, I know all about myself. All my thought process throughout the day is centered around me. How many million times in the course of the day does the word I stand foremost? You see, everything else which constitutes the cosmos is the not-self. It is other than me. So I am vividly conscious of myself and only vaguely conscious, vaguely aware of the not-self. Generally speaking, of course, you see. Hence the fundamental duality, hence the state of conflict. Because each person in the world, and there are 5 billions of them nowadays, unfortunately, and fortunately too, they all think like that. I am I. I want this. I desire that. I am aspiring to this. I am trying to obtain this, etc. And each person thinks and feels differently from every other person. So, the state of the possibility of conflict is everlastingly present throughout the world. This separative and isolative I consciousness, I am I consciousness, self-consciousness, is the root of all the trouble in the world where our human life is concerned. Of course, there is trouble with natural phenomena, earthquakes, floods, flaming June at 13 degrees, and so forth. You see? But those things we can't deal with. We have no power to deal with that. What we have power to deal with and the opportunity is ourselves. We can deal with ourselves. Become free of this isolativeness and this separativeness. Science itself, from the beginning of this century, has shown clearly that everything in the cosmos is completely interrelated and continuously interactive. The cosmos is a universe, not a multiverse. It's that unitary wholeness that has to become the normal condition throughout the world. When that is the case, and its root lies in individual human consciousness, when that unitary wholeness has become the normal state, we shall not have hijacks, wars, robberies, rapes, murders, and all the rest of the horror that afflicts mankind. This consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness is, if you like to use that word, the divine consciousness. When people ask, why doesn't God prevent this, that and the other evil? God is conscious in terms of unitary wholeness. And he knows that he can't chuck anything out of the cosmos which he brought into being. That's that. So everything is accepted, not accepted in the sense that it is not to be transformed into something better, but it is accepted as part of that totality. Nothing is rejected. And it is man who can realize that type of divine consciousness. You know, Krishnamurti, in his way, without using my terminology, has been trying to present that in a remarkable manner. To be awake, to be aware of everything without reacting for or against it. In the unitarily whole consciousness, everything has its place. If I have a unitarily whole consciousness, then I will not hate or try to destroy the evil doer. I will wait patiently until his transformation takes place, his conversion takes place. He turns away from. The Buddha taught the same sort of thing. The bhikkhu turns away from this, that and the other because it produces dukkha. Nibindati. Turns away from. He is converted. So it is not self-consciousness, but the isolativeness and the separativeness which we have to look at and deal with. Then we are reduced, and when that dealing reaches its culmination, we are reduced to our own nothingness, our no-thingness. Now, what is the significance of that? It is not that we are annihilated in any sense at all. There is no such thing as annihilation anywhere. But we are conscious of ourselves and other people also, more or less in the same manner as we are conscious of what we call things, a piano, a book, a game, or whatever it is in our life, daily life, a thing. I am a thing. The other person is a thing. Very frequently, for the lover, his beloved is a plaything. This thingness dissolves. It becomes a no-thing. And the no-thing is transcendence itself. And that happens, of course, in consciousness. When thingness as the manifested object or the manifested organism reaches that stage of utter selflessness, then the no-thing is present. Transcendence is there. The quality of his consciousness at work is in terms of perfection, in terms of divinity. So, we cannot know the transcendent, but the transcendence knows us. You know that in Genesis chapter 4, the first verse, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived. Of course, the whole of Christendom interprets that in ordinary biological terms. And Adam knew his wife, meaning he had marital relations with her, and she conceived. Now, biologically, that is just what happens. All right. But transcendentally, what does it mean? Look, the subsequent sentences might help. The beloved who truly gives herself to love swoons. The lover knows her. Recovering from the swoon, which is the unself-conscious state, a conception grows, for the natural tendency of the surface mind, the psychical process, the conscious verbalizer, is to set limits to the infinite and formulate a spatio-temporal experience out of the spaceless and timeless experiencing, and strange are the results of such conceiving. Now, he who is the true lover, unreservedly, unconditionally, and totally gives his whole being to the beloved. The Bible put it in masculine-feminine terms, quite sensibly, you see. And if I totally, unreservedly give ourselves to transcendence, in order that transcendence may fulfill itself as the perfect human through each of us, then we swoon. We lose consciousness. A swoon is a loss of consciousness, isn't it? In this case, it is the loss, it is the giving up, the freedom from, I should say, all separative self-consciousness. That swooning is actually the union, the unio mystica, the union with transcendence. And transcendence, of course, knows that. Knows not in terms of thought or speech or anything like that, but that transcendent knowing is the peak point of consciousness at the transcendental level, not at our level. The peak point of consciousness at our levels has been expressed in Buddhism, for instance, when in meditation you enter that stage which is called the cessation of all thought and feeling, etc. You see? And in the Upanishadic teachings, you have the complete becoming Brahman. They don't merely say you are united with Brahman, because when you use a phrase like that, it implies a you, that's one, and Brahman, that's second. You see, so there is still a duality. The separative consciousness has completely vanished. There is no separate I in that state. You see? So, the transcendent knowing by transcendence is the transcendental consciousness itself. I have tried sometimes to explain what I mean by this being conscious. We think, we feel, we make mental shapes and so forth. We think we know this, we know the other. Yes, you can know how to cook your dinner, you can know how to play a piano or play cricket or whatever it is, in the ordinary way. But that kind of knowing by the psychophysical organism is entirely different from being conscious. When you are truly conscious of anything, say a quality like love or truth or whatever it is, truth and love inevitably, invariably, naturally and spontaneously express themselves through your total living process as a psychophysical organism. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to try to express it. It just is the natural thing. Just as from the sun, light, heat and all the rest is the natural process thing, you see. Now, of course, people might say, oh, but this sort of idealism is too airy-fairy. Well, it is only the too airy-fairy which is the worthwhile. I say so now, I'll say so to the end of my days, which perhaps are not very far now. So, in that total giving to the totality of course is conscious in the sense in which we ascribe omniscience to the divine. That is the omniscience. It doesn't know it as a process, a procedure, as a thing, as a happening or anything. That sort of knowing is actually being the thing. And the being inevitably results in doing. Action and seeing truly are one and the same thing. The action need not always be physical. You know, Krishnamurti has also presented this idea that when you really see, action is there. Truly experiencing the immeasurable is indescribable. The unknown, the infinite, cannot be crammed into the known and finite mold of speech thought. Thinking, speaking about the transcendent only forges mental images of the imageless. A game of make-believe like the fantasy play of an imaginative child. You know, throughout history, man has played with thinking and speaking about what he considers is the supreme being or God or whatever it is. And look at all the God conceptions that have been presented in the world. They are potty little misrepresentations of the transcendent. They really are. God is the all-loving. He is the all-knowing. He is the perfect justiciar. He is the perfect lover. He's the father, he's the mother, etc., 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 ad infinitum. But look at every one of these words. You or I am also loving and truthful, am just, and so forth, in my little way. So, God is being the super me, must necessarily have all this in the super state, and in the super degree, which is all nonsensical, because in the context of the infinite and the eternal, there is no such thing as comparison, there are no grades, there are no degrees. You see, if you ever have a touch of that state of transcendence, even a touch, a single touch, you will suddenly see that everything that we are acquainted with here in the finite and temporal condition is negated. There is no here, there is no there, there is no past, present, future. There ain't nothing anywhere. Where the transcendent is concerned. And it's an extraordinary state. And if one ever has that touch, it releases an indescribable energy, a power, a strength within oneself, which makes one fit to express that transcendence. You know how in the Katha Upanishad, the Lord of Death says to Nachiketas, Nachiketas is a fit vessel for the supreme teaching, for the supreme knowledge. Now, the living experiencing is truth in the religious sense. It is the real knowing of God. The images made by the mind, the verbal formulations set down in a book, even in holy writ, however stimulating or inspiring, are but expressions of conceiving and bringing forth, excrescences of the ineffable reality. That is why in the supreme stages, the disciple and the teacher communicate without words. Mind they don't have two different minds. There is just the one mind operating through both of them simultaneously. Needs no words. And it is the consciousness of the disciple which is utterly transmuted, not merely transformed, but utterly transmuted by that spiritual induction, as I've called it in this book, from the teacher. The expressions are but a tomb of the truth. Man, the living immortal, must rise out of the tomb, leaving in it merely a bundle of clothes, an astonishment to the unawakened. You get what I'm driving at? The two Marys who went into the tomb where Jesus was supposed to be found no body there, only a bundle of clothes. The clothes which cover the body. And the body is a living thing. Yes, of course, as the Bible puts it, he was supposed to be dead. But he wasn't dead, actually. They did not find the living thing. They found all the excrescences, the wrappings. That is what we do when we try to, when we go for the religious life. We study all the scriptures. And we have great professors and philosophers and so forth producing tome after tome of useless stuff, more or less, in connection with that living truth. You see how they do it and why they do it? We are so conditioned from our birth onwards that we believe that the thought process is the way in to see the transcendent. You can't see the transcendent through a thought process any more than you can see transcendence, God, with your physical eyes. It's not possible. When yoga presents the idea of the third eye, what it refers to is this touch of transcendence which has affected your consciousness and completely transformed it. Completely transformed it. Then what words can you use to speak about it but the words which we use in connection with our senses? We see. People have written, mystics have written, I saw God. I saw the divine. But you can't see God with these two eyes. It's quite impossible. You can be conscious of the divine in everything to such a degree that you are compelled to say, I have seen God. I remember very well a very charming Dutch speaker say at a conference, God spoke to me. I heard him. I saw him. From everything else that speaker said or did in that conference, it was perfectly clear that the poor man was considerably deluded. Now the expressions. All expressions have a form. Form, nevertheless, must not be despised. Its very limitations are the goads that move us to transcendence. Thought itself can serve the purpose of laying bare the fact that all images are but idols. Because when the thought process develops and grows more and more receptive, more sensitive, more refined, you find that the old idols are all cast aside. New idols are set up. But because the person is aware of the fact that that is what is happening, he knows, he comes to know that all these images produced by thought are only idols. And speech itself can sound the alarm that deflects us from the rape of truth. Man's talk, our talk, my talk, anybody's talk, is but a ghost of the picture of the living reality. We can see that and understand that as a fact. If we do understand that, then we won't get captivated by anybody who speaks or writes. We shall listen, we shall consider with as quiet a mind as possible, and in that process, the purification of the whole psyche can go on. This quiet consideration. A consideration which has no argument, which does not have thoughts for or against that which is being considered. One is quiet. Look at the question, why doesn't God? He is quiet. That's why he doesn't. If thought speech be pure, the human dialogue can lift our eyes to the stars. Then, if it is possible to empty the mind, now this book was written 12 years ago, remember, I mean all these, the last parts of it anyway, and I've used the word mind continuously, because in both Hindu and Christian writings, and in Hindu, Christian, Buddhist and other writings, the word mind is used. It is to the Greeks that we owe the word psyche. It's a very good word and a very necessary word. That's why in the chapter on mind, psyche, karma, in chapter 16, I have differentiated psyche from mind very definitely. And it is not the mind which has to be emptied, it's the psyche. See, mind is this universal energy, this particular archetypal form of the primordial creative energy, which is responsible as the formative influence where the entire cosmos is concerned. That is mind. That is why I never say my mind, your mind. My psyche, your psyche. Yes, that is specifically ours. This particular form of the creative energy interacting with matter, the body, and where the human body is concerned, especially the brain and nervous system, the ductless glands and so on, gives rise to psyche. The psyche is rooted in the material of the body. Definitely rooted in the material of the body. The body is the apparatus through which the energy the embodied energy of transcendence has to work. And in that, in the process of the development, the psyche comes into being. Because, you see, every human body is different from every other human body. It is true that in certain respects all bodies are alike, bones, flesh, skin, blood, and so on, you see. But in a million and one other aspects, we are all different from each other, uniquely different from each other. And so, this characterless universal energy, mind, acting with the characterized body, produces the intellectual, emotional, the mental phenomena, as we call them, in our ordinary everyday life. That is the psyche. And it is that psyche which is conditioned, which is impure, which is ignorant, and so forth, and forms all the images. And that has to be purified. This is where the discipline of the religious life in its true sense comes in. So, empty the psyche of all its images, its illusions and delusions, the divine dialogue can take place. For the emptied psyche, spacious and silent, does not hinder the experiencing of the transcendent. You see, for the simple reason that my psyche interferes, it makes me opaque to the light of transcendence. But when the psyche is completely purified, it has become identical with pure mind. And that is universal mind. And that is why people have ascribed omniscience to the perfected holy ones.